This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilash and John McElroy, episode 420 for May 11th, 2018. 2019 Ram 1500 from top to bottom. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Well, welcome everybody to AutoLine After Hours, and Mr. Gary Vasilash, how you be?
I'm doing really well. How about yourself?
We say this all the time. I'm doing great.
You're doing great, yeah. So I was down in Orlando this week at the NPE show, which is the National Plastics Exposition show, and you would not believe how massive this thing is. I mean, on Tuesday, I was just looking at my phone. I walked 6 miles, and I wasn't even trying. It's just
you saw a lot of plastic.
I saw a lot of plastic. I mean, you know, you can make the graduate jokes and, you know, boy, these people are serious about that, but it is amazing, and a lot of it is automotive-related, as this whole lightweighting thing is going on.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm sure we'll get to.
Yes,
I'm sure we will, too, because we have to let everybody know that our guest today is Rob Wickman. He's the director of Ram Truck Engineering, and welcome to AutoLine After Hours.
Thank you. Great to be here, and can't wait to talk about the truck.
Well, let's start talking about it. You know, what I'm curious about is you were given this whole program to run from the very get-go.
Yep.
What were the main goals that you set out to achieve versus the old one, which has been no slouch? It's been selling really well, but what did you guys feel that you really had to change with the new one?
About three and a half years ago, maybe 4 years ago, a lot of customer input, and then over the years from the previous model, you gain. And, you know, what do you want to go after? Capability was one.
What, more towing, more hauling?
Yep, absolutely. We wanted customers to say, like, a little bit more capability. In doing so, we didn't want to deter from the ride, but we wanted to improve our steering. We wanted to improve our braking. We wanted to improve the efficiencies of the truck as well. That would be come from aero, weight reduction, powertrain improvements, crash worthiness as well, passive and active. That comes into some of the technologies that we have. Mm-hmm. And then continue to evolve the design, right, from where the truck is now to the 2019 that you see here today. And that's from an exterior standpoint and interior standpoint.
Well, you know, a truck starts out with the bones, the chassis. Let's start there. What'd you do differently with the chassis on this one?
We've touched every component. So let's start off with some of the efficiencies, light weighting, 98% uses of high-strength steel within the frame, 100 pounds out of the frame, 120 out of the rolling chassis.
Because of this lightweight steel?
Absolutely. And also used aluminum on the frame as well in strategic places, our transmission cross member, and then when we hook in our lower control arms. But once again, mention about the ride. We didn't want to deter from the ride. We've increased our payload, 2,300-pound max payload. And that kind of goes across our models a little bit less, but all of our payload has increased. Didn't want to deter from the ride. How do we do that? Our class exclusive recoil springs, we have variable rate coils now. So we didn't get any issues from a customer perspective. A lot of light-duty customers drive around with air versus any type of load. We have FRD shocks, frequency response dampening shocks.
Which means what?
Basically, it's a dual valve shock. It's the best combination of ride handling and comfort. So you have the first primary valve for minor inputs, and then when that bottoms out, you go to the secondary valve. Really nice input. We've redone our mounts as far as from road input.
Mounts, body mounts? Or?
Both. Both mounts. And then from our front end suspension, we increased our roll stiffness 20%, primarily by taking our front sway bar and flipping it 180 degrees. And,
how's that stiffen it up?
It just, as far as from a drive perspective, you got better geometry points. As far as our light weighting of our frame, we changed our geometry a little bit. We knew where we could improve upon, and we're not talking inches, so our box section got a little bit narrow, a little bit taller by millimeters, and that allowed our geometry points to change slightly and really improved the ride. The first vehicle I drove in the prototype phase, from currently driving a current eight, well, at the time it was a 17, and into the prototype, it was like, wow, we've got something here.
Even in a prototype.
Yeah, it was like, well, you guys, are you sure this is the right suspension? Yeah, no, this is it. This is just, and we're not done yet. So, and Gary, you've had a chance to drive it
sure.
as well.
Sure, it's absolutely amazing. But the question I have is, Rob, you have six different trim levels, and what you just described in terms of the shocks and, mm-hmm. and other aspects. So, is this across the board?
Across as far as the shocks, the mounts, the cab mounts, across the board, the springs across the board. And the only difference, let's say, to the FRD shocks on our Rebel version, we have the Bilsteins. Mm-hmm. That's the only difference. We have an off-road package as well, where we've tuned our shocks to those applications. So you get a good ride on, no matter if it's the work truck as our tradesman level or as a limited.
I've got to ask you about that off-road thing, because, I mean, it's just crazy good. I mean, did you work with your Jeep colleagues on any of that?
We have a really good chassis department and our vehicle dynamics department that know trucks and that currently grew on that trucks and then developed it. It's kind of like our current Rebel, our 18 Rebel is good, and this is like better. And once again, knowing those minor suspension points and then driving it further. So it's a 1-inch lifted on the steel. It's a 1-inch lifted truck, but the rear geometry is set specifically for that 1-inch versus just taking a current truck and lifting it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it also comes with our class exclusive air suspension.
Mm-hmm. Rob, there's something on the chassis too. Didn't you guys bolt something on to reduce NVH and
yeah.
the like? What is that?
That's part of our fuel saver mode on our Hemi engine. So our fuel saver mode is when our Hemi engine goes into four-cylinder mode. And we used to have a no-fly zone. And a no-fly zone is basically you want to stay out of here because you get a vibration, you also get an audible standpoint. So we've pushed it. That's part of the efficiency story. We've pushed that a little bit. So you do get some vibration. We needed to take care of it. So on each side of the outside of the rail is an ATMM, a active tomb mass module. And basically it's a cylinder with a magnet inside that shakes 180 degrees out of phase. And it has a sensor on it, so it picks up the vibration on the frame. And then it will shake 100 degrees or 180 degrees out of sync, and it eliminates the vibration that a customer may pick up in the steering wheel or the seat or the floor pan.
Where did that come from? I mean, that's
engine mount design. Actually, Hutchinson happens to be the supplier, but they've done it on engine mounts, and that's direct. And we've taken that technology, we've taken it to the frame. And I did mention there's an audible side to this as well. That's why we have ANC. So that, once again, pumps
noise cancellation.
I have noise cancellation, microphones in the headliner, and then it pumps that cancellation noise through the speakers and the subwoofer.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty wild. Has anybody else attached this kind of attenuator to the chassis?
No. I think that we are first in the industry to attach it to the chassis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, if you didn't have cylinder deactivation, this wouldn't be necessary?
Yeah, not available or not required on our Pentastar engine, our 3.6 liter.
Right. So it's just a...
For our Hemi engine, once again,
pushing
that fuel economy, and the customer just enjoys a pleasant ride.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we started with the chassis. Let's talk about the suspension and steering. You mentioned the coil springs. What else did you do differently with the suspension?
As far as relative suspension, we can get primarily like our brakes. Our suspension hasn't changed much from... once again, just tweak the geometry points. Front control arms, our lowers are aluminum, uppers are composite. Nylon reinforced over
composite.
Upper arms.
Small. Is this a first for trucks?
This is a first for trucks, to the best of my knowledge. Yes.
Wow. And so, what over kind of composite
steel.
Are they?
Stamped steel, nylon reinforced over stamped steel bracket.
Very interesting.
Once again, the strengths and lightweighting associated with that. And now, for some customers that like 22s on a 4x4, we offer it.
That's one way to get bigger tires and wheels.
That is true. Yeah.
You've got big brakes in the front on this.
We do. We've increased our rotor size approximately an inch, 14.9. Piston side, we have two pistons in the front, 57 millimeters, a little bit larger than today's. Going after best-in-class braking, mm-hmm. and from a customer feel, really solid. Really, really good brake.
How do you measure that? 100 to 0, 60 to 0? Yeah, what kind of measurements are you?
60 to 0.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll see how that comes out in the near future. But
so
yes.
you got to wait to what? Chevy Sprint know if you've
beat
them,
absolutely.
Right?
We'll see how our competitors set up. Yep.
And what's the steering system on this vehicle?
As far as our steering system, it's electric. Yep. Mm-hmm. And that enables some of the features relative to our lane keep assist, where we got the haptic feedback, parallel and perpendicular park assist, really nice features on a light-duty pickup truck.
So is it rack-mounted or column-mounted?
I think I believe rack-mounted, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, rack-mounted.
Okay, let's talk body a little bit. You know, besides making it beautiful, and you've touched a little bit on aerodynamics.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about aero.
Well, do. Go.
Aero is one of the things that we ran into that was an extremely great outcome. 9% improvement over our current truck.
And put that in perspective. Yeah, 9% is like...
0.357 is a coefficient of drag.
Okay.
So 0.357 exiting truck is 0.393. Significant from an aero perspective. Two of those come from active features. One of them is our active air dam. That's 40% of the 9%.
So, and what's that, like a chin spoiler that deploys?
It's a dam that deploys at 35 miles an hour, and it retracts at 15 miles an hour. And it's offered on all of our trucks except for the Rebel off-road and our air suspension, because our air suspension has an aero mode. 60 miles an hour, it drops 0.6 of an inch, providing that. And the air dam also is clutch. So for some of you that may run into stuff, it'll get out of the way and it won't break, which is good. The second active feature is our grill shutters. Mm-hmm. Those clothes provide aero improvement, also provide fast heater warm-up, which is good.
Oh, yeah.
Other feature which I like to note is in the rear, the top of our cab as it comes by, there's like a dovetail version, or excuse me, there's a dovetail cutout in the upper hood. And then we raised our box 38 millimeters. And that combination gave us another 40% reduction in aero, significant aero improvement.
Not only that, it makes your bed deeper then.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah,
it's actually more usable.
Three and a half cubic feet in the rear. And that was one where we worked with design office. And a lot of times there's creative tension between us and design office. There's no tension on that one. But none
for increasing the box size?
Box size and also in the roof, where we have that dovetail in the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they just thought it looks like a cool-looking feature. That
they bought right into it, because sometimes our aerodynamics just no one may want to buy a vehicle if they had their free realm of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but every inch of this truck, including all the spats, have been gone over. Every millimeter, every OE does the same thing just to make sure you get the optimum amount of aero improvement.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk powertrain, too.
What
different engine options? V6 and V8, essentially,
yeah, V6
right?
And V8 we've launched with our 5.7 liter, and then very shortly we'll come out with our 5.7 liter e-torque system.
So this is the Hemi, though. You got to say it.
Yeah, it's the Hemi.
For the people who don't know that, I think that's
5.7 liter Hemi, right? And our customer base is really wants the 5.7 liter and wants the V8 power. And it comes with, once again, our fuel saver mode. So you get the best of both worlds. You get the power. And it's got a great exhaust note as well. Mm-hmm. But our e-torque systems are coming up. They will be out shortly, and that's on the 5.7 liter Hemi and also our 3.6 liter Pentastar.
So explain how that works. I mean,
yeah, so an e-torque system, it's a mild hybrid.
48 volt.
And we have a MGU unit, which is a motor generator unit. And it's right on the top of the engine on the 5.7 liter. It drives an 8-rib bolt down to the crank. It provides that startup. It eliminates the alternators for stop-start. It starts at the startup. And it's very smooth. It's really hard to detect, and you guys will be driving those shortly. And then we have a 48-volt battery that sits behind the rear driver's seat. And that supplies the power to the 12-volt battery and then also provides the power to the startup. And it's about 130 pound-feet of torque within, like, less than 5 seconds to get that engine started up, and then the torque curve of the engine comes up.
So does it do anything when you're driving the vehicle?
Yeah, so as far as regenerative braking, so it's positively torqued, and then it takes negative torque for regenerate, and that provides a source of battery power.
So does that regen braking help with the best-in-class braking that you were talking about earlier?
Not so much, more for charging the battery.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, we got a question here from Nick Bridges. He wrote in to ask, the horsepower and torque figures for the Hemi V8 are the same as the e-torque Hemi V8, but the e-torque maximum tow rating is 1,140 pounds higher. How does the eTorque technology deliver this higher max tow rating?
Should be the same. I'm gonna say on that a clarification should be exactly the same in between the 5.7 and the 5.7 eTorque. The eTorque system isn't like an additive relative to overall horsepower or torque numbers. It's just at that initial beginning. So it's 130 pound feet on the Hemi, and then 90 on the Pentastar engine.
Uh-huh. And let's see. Mike Flowers says, how will eTorque affect tuning, like bolt-ons or supercharging?
Well, that's an interesting
question. Because you know some people are going to do that.
Yeah. I think with the right software packages, it should marry in. Yeah, it should marry in.
He wants to know if Mopar is going to have performance add-ons as well.
Mopar always works on performance add-ons, and as simple as a cold air induction system.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And what transmission transmissions?
Eight-speed transmission.
That's got to help with the fuel economy numbers. Also.
Yeah, and it's our second gen eight-speed transmission. Actually, we increased its capability from a CPU standpoint, so it's able to react much quicker. You think it's a minor point, but it really the shift points on this truck are phenomenal. So.
Okay, Jeff Wooden wrote in to say he really likes the new Ram 1500, but he says he may need a 2500 for towing. What he wants to know is, will the 2500 get all the interior and safety upgrades the 1500 just got?
So, you know, I can't talk about the future, but can't talk about the future at the moment. But I'm happy to be here.
Directionally, maybe the 1500 points the way. Maybe.
Yeah.
Right. So when we looked at this truck at the auto show, the Detroit show where it was first revealed, one of the things that both you and I were very impressed with was the interior with the integration of that 12-inch
screen. Yeah, absolutely.
So I've got to ask you, how easy or difficult was it for you guys to integrate something like that into a pickup truck versus integrating that into a Tesla Model S or something?
A lot of discussions. You know Ryan Nagode, head of mm-hmm. interiors, and really great working relationship with Ryan, and a lot of discussions went in exactly. A lot of engineering of where it goes, how high it should go, the angle associated with it, where we're going to put we call it the silver box. It's the box that goes behind it. It's the brains associated with it that controls the radio. So a lot of engineering where our switch bank needs to be underneath, how it integrates the controls associated with it. But I think we did a pretty good job. But I'll let our customers be the judge of that and yourself.
Yeah. Greg H. Writes in to say the assisted V6, I guess he means the eTorque V6, looks like a winner that should be able to compete with the F-150's MPGs. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, I think everyone will be impressed when we come out with our numbers relative to the eTorque systems, relative mm-hmm. to fuel economy, for sure.
Miro Caffert wants to know, what kind of battery do you use in that 48-volt system?
It's a manganese nickel carbide battery.
Oh, really?
Specifically. Yeah, it's a 48-volt battery. Mm-hmm. Basically, it looks like a suitcase.
Mm-hmm.
Fits nicely behind the seat. No customer is ever going to see it because it's behind the cab back panel. Does have a fan in there, so it controls its temperature, and it exhausts out through our rear exhausters.
Mm-hmm.
Does that add mass? I mean, you guys were very...
Oh, yeah.
You guys were very keen on getting mass out of this thing.
Yeah, it's a balance. We've used a lot of technologies, and we balanced overall 225-pound weight reduction. But I'll let you think of a few things. We increased the cab length 4 inches. We have 14.9-inch rotors for our brakes. We have an eTorque system with a battery, and we dropped weight. So it's a combination of all of this.
And you didn't make an aluminum truck. So, I mean, how did you do this?
We balanced the technologies out. And I think instead of our strategy was not take it and stick it into one technology, and then that's the money, because it costs a significant amount to do a new truck. We've kind of spread it out. And we spread it out. We believe we've got the right strategy.
Overall mass is down about 200 pounds?
Yeah, 225.
Okay.
Yep, 100 out of the body in the box, and about 120 out of the rolling chassis.
Bob Oberton wants to know, why don't you have an extended cab? like Ford and GM have. He says, I would buy an extended version in a heartbeat, even though the two back doors only open when the front doors are open.
Yeah, we've a lot of our customer feedback about 3.5-4 years ago is, you know, everything's on the plate at that moment in time. And as we whittle it down, they really want four doors. And they wanted a rear seat, like, larger. They want more room in the rear. They want a reclining rear seat. And that's why the majority of the customers really wanted that. Yeah. So
you made the cab bigger
inside. Yep.
Is the overall length longer?
Did you
sacrifice bed or no?
Nope, didn't sacrifice bed.
But the
overall
longer.
Length, yes, we did. We did get longer. Yes, we did. So it's about our crew with the 5'7" is about 19 and a half feet, little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Is there some spec that you have to meet that you can't go beyond in terms of?
There's a garageable size, and we're very close to that. We're on top of our competition for sure on length.
Once again, it's
a balance.
Isaiah Lopez and a few others want to know, what about the quality? You know, what have you done to make sure the quality is going to be better?
Yeah, absolutely. Our customers and the feedback that you get from some of our friends at J.D. Powers and CQI, all of this feedback comes in, and we have attacked those as we have gone through. As simple as our corrosion protection underneath, we've improved that. Currently on our 18 and then on the all-new Ram 1500 HVAC system. It's a brand new HVAC system here. Our customers are like, hey, I don't like the noise that comes out of the HVAC, the blower, and then also in the rear seat from heating and cooling. I'd like more. So we've answered that with the all-new Ram.
Mm-hmm. We've got a number of questions here about hybrids, even fuel cells.
Yeah.
But Dave Tuttle also wants to know, what about a plug-in hybrid version?
All those are always looked at, right? This is our first step with eTorque, and then we see where we go in the future.
So maybe more to come.
Maybe more to come for sure.
Diesel you haven't mentioned either.
Diesel's coming out next year.
Okay.
We will have a diesel, and we currently have a diesel in our 18. Mm-hmm. And which is available, which has very good fuel economy.
You guys have had a pretty high take rate at times. It looks like to me like it's come down a little bit. I want to say you were at over 20%.
This is on diesel specific.
Just diesel.
Yeah, you're right about right. Yeah, right. We run right about 20% on our diesels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's a great truck. I mean, I don't know if you've had an opportunity to drive the current Dia. It doesn't really sound like a diesel.
Yeah.
And it's got great performance.
So this has an aluminum tailgate. That's the only body panel?
Yeah, let's talk about aluminum. We have aluminum hood, and we do have aluminum hood in our 2018 model. Okay. And then we decided to do aluminum tailgate as well.
Is that just for effort?
Actually, to tell you the truth, it's a 15-pound weight savings. So as we've gone down that path, it was like we used it strategically in certain areas. Also, the cross members underneath, mm-hmm. strategically used aluminum. One other just notable why we're talking about the tailgate is our D section or our pillars. We used a manufacturing process called hydroforming with advanced high strength steel, and it's a tube D pillar that comes from one side down all the way all the way across and then up on the other side. Came in as a 9-pound weight savings. So using high strength steel manufacturing process and dropping the weight.
Does it also help in terms of the structural integrity back there?
It is. I have not received any durability issues associated with the box. We don't do new boxes all the time. Last time we did it is 2009. We haven't had any box durability because it really ties in the rear of that truck. It's nice.
There's been some launch issues with the truck. I know you're not involved in manufacturing, but
like this with manufacturing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
did they come back to you and go, "Why'd you design it this way?" Or what?
From a harmony standpoint, working with manufacturing, hand in hand, all the way. Of course, there's minor tweaks as we come up, but it's getting a brand new truck up and running. And that's one of the reasons why we have the Hemi now, and then we're coming out with our eTorque systems very soon.
Mm-hmm. So talk to us about the differences between the base model and a limited model like this. I mean, what are the things that you guys are bringing to the truck?
Yeah, as far as from the base, the current Tradesman model.
As you load the content
in. Yeah, for sure. A lot of it's interior-based. And wheels as well. So we have 18-inch wheels on our base, and then we roll all the way up to 22s on our limited version. Our door trim panels, very basic door trim panel all the way up to our Longhorn Limited, where we use real wood within the door trim panels. IPs, basic structure is the same, but as far as the materials used, we go all the way up. Upper glove, an example is the upper glove box. We have a door in our Longhorn Limited and Laramie models as optional. Our base model don't have it. Mm-hmm. But what is nice is when you do go in our base model, it's a nice truck.
Mm-hmm. And when you're in your top of the line model,
it's a
like,
fantastic truck.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, you've got enough leather in there to.
There's a couple,
a couple of cows in there, right?
Yep, it's some good leather. And the ride difference in between the two is essentially the same.
Mm-hmm. SubGR77 says, why not go with a 10-speed transmission?
It's all about efficiency. If a 10-speed transmission on our configuration would have got us to a better spot, we would have went after it. But right now, from 8-speed, e-torque system.
That's an important point. Once you have that e-torque, you don't need as many gears in the transmission,
exactly.
Do you?
Exactly, yes.
Great point.
Yep.
Let's see, a couple of other really good questions here. Miro Kafer wrote in to ask, with the 48-volt battery, any possibility to have the AC working for a limited amount of time when the engine is off?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what we have. That's one of the items that that people think is when the engine shuts off and you're at a light, everything else shuts down. And that's not the case. And what's great, it's fully automatic. So if it's a hot day and you have the air conditioning on, engine shuts down, sometimes you don't even notice. The only thing you notice is you just hear the pure tone of your air conditioning. Man, it stays there. And if it needs, the engine will restart.
Can you shut that off?
The e-torque. Yeah, you sure can. And actually, it's right on our rotary knob. All of our controls are right there. And if you're one that doesn't care for it, you can just rotate and push the off button.
Speaking of the rotary knob, Barry Rector wants to know, how have drivers taken to that rotary knob?
Much better. It was, at the beginning, there was a lot of feedback.
Why? I think it's great.
Yeah, I don't really
People
know.
People don't like change.
I think exactly, especially some of our truck customers don't like change. And hey, I just like to do this, and this is what
pull
I do.
Pull the lever down.
Yeah, just pull the lever down. This is what I have to do. Now, granted, myself, I've driven trucks for the 28 years I've been at Chrysler, and I came from a heavy duty. So I came from a heavy duty. No, I'm going to work on this program. Got to get into a light duty, and it's took me a long time to as I back into my driveway, I do this and say, oh, no, I got to do this. Now it's natural.
Was there a shifter on the column on the 09 version?
For the heavy-duty truck.
But, I mean, just for the 1500?
Yeah, I think 14 is when we went in the rotary knob.
Hmm.
Yeah. But it does. It's a creature of habit. I mean, and I experienced it because I went right from a heavy duty to a light duty, and I don't have that anymore. And I gotta do this. And sometimes like, oh, I gotta do this. But once you get used to it, it's like, oh, this is great.
I just like getting the lever out of the way.
Yeah.
It just opens up, whole area.
Yeah, absolutely.
I actually like that better than the shifter that are on some of the.
This takes a valuable space.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Vince Kennedy wants to know, is there a future for the Hemi?
Our customers are still demanding the Hemi, and that's why we put it in this truck for the e-torque. So
then there is a future for it. Dave Tuttle wants to know, what do you think about Elon Musk's idea for a pickup truck, fully independent suspension with air springs? Well, you guys got
mm-hmm.
air springs.
Yeah.
Four-wheel drive implemented fairly simply by having front and rear motors. Any thoughts about what Tesla's talking about?
Yeah. Once again, in the advanced state, if that's what drives it, and that's what the customers want.
So, from an engineering point of view, it's conceivable.
Oh yeah, you could put motors at the wheels for sure. Yeah. If that's what the customer wants, and then you have to meet all the requirements. You know, the 4x4 version, the 4x2 version. Is it a go fast truck? Is it a low torque truck? All those items have to be put into the cookbook and see where we come.
Okay, I know it's running down the line right now as we speak, but as you look at the truck, do you think, dang, we should have done this, or I would have done that differently?
That's a good question. Let's see, what would we have done differently? I don't know. I haven't taken that step back and say, hey, you know what?
That's a good sign. There's no major screw up where you went, no.
Well, definitely not that I would tell you. No, I'm just, kidding.
Okay, let's flip that around. Yeah. So when you look at that truck, what do you say to yourself, damn, I'm happy we did that. I'm really proud of that.
I would say the best thing, and I'm going to go back to the ride. I think the ride is something that we've put a lot of things together on this truck. We increased the length of the truck. A lot of these are influences to the ride, and the ride's just so nice. Especially when you walk out of your 18 and you walk into this, it's just like, wow, this is nice, and the quietness associated with it. And maybe it's a combination. Maybe I got it wrong. I'm talking the ride, but maybe it's the ride. Maybe Ryan did such a great job on the interior, and maybe it's the quietness from our acoustic glass and our ceiling features that we have within the truck. That's what's super nice about this.
The thing that surprised me about it was how maneuverable it was as I was going through parking lots of shopping malls with this thing. I mean, oftentimes I'm in a truck and I'm like, damn, I'm in a truck. But when I was in this, I was, you know, I didn't have that feeling. That's, I mean, it wasn't.
Were you using some of the features? And the features would have been the cameras, the 360 camera. Was it in parking or was it just maneuverability?
Just maneuverability.
That's great. That's really good to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing to me. And I drove through more parking lots than I wanted to. But I had an enjoyable experience while
Excellent.
I did so.
Very good. Very good.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap up this segment, but Rob Wickman, thanks so much for coming on, talking about the Ram, bringing one into the studio, too.
Thank you very much.
As the audience knows, we love having trucks or any kind of vehicle in the studio, but thanks again for your time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having the new truck as well. And,
okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break here, and we'll be back talking more about what's going on in the automotive industry.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
All right, we're back. It's me and Gary.
So, are you up for a question or up for a number?
I am up for a number.
All right, so this will lead into some conversation. So, Katie or Carmen, could you please bring up the first slide?
4 million U.S. workers, 90-plus minutes per day.
So what might 400 million U.S. workers spend 90 minutes a day doing?
I don't know. Going to the bathroom?
Boy, we'd be in some productivity trouble if that were the case.
Going to the bathroom and eating lunch. Going to the bathroom, eating lunch, looking at Facebook and Twitter.
Okay, none of which are automotive, and it does have an automotive angle to it.
Oh, okay.
Or, yeah, I'll just, because if I say more, I'll
give it away. Well, you're going to have to tell me.
All right, so let's bring it up. And they spend that much time commuting to work. So these people are called super commuters. And the next one, please. So it's interesting to note that those who go less than 90 minutes, you know, you'll find that there'll be a good percentage of them that will consider public transportation. But these long guys are different on that. So... And so this comes from apartmentlist.com. And the cities where this is really keen are, next one, final one. So you notice, so if we were doing this in order, it would start with Stockton and then go all the way down to L.A.
Yeah.
And so what you're finding is that these people who are working in cities like San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in New York, are having to go further and further out, which means they're spending a hell of a lot of time in their motor vehicles trying to get to work. And so it just strikes me as being somewhat amazing that, you know, that people would spend that much time just trying to get to work. So, you know, what does this say about our transportation system going forward?
It says there's a huge opportunity for autonomous cars so that you can do whatever you want while you're spending 90 minutes a day in it.
See, but what, okay, so The question then becomes, is this going to be an autonomous car that you are going to spend your time individually going to work and back? Or would this be you and three other people that you may or may not know?
Probably be both situations.
That there'd be a combination
of
these things.
Well, you know, if you split the ride, now the cost is cheaper.
Right.
So, yeah, you got to share a vehicle with people. But I believe we're going to see vehicles designed for this purpose, where you're going to have your own little personal cocoon.
So you think, so this would be a cocoon within a vehicle, or
yes,
a cocoon that would be like a pod-like
vehicle?
No,
cocoon. And when I say cocoon, what I mean is, you know, like this thing that Harman has invented called individual sound zones,
mm-hmm,
that through noise cancellation, when you're sitting in your seat, you can crank up the music as loud as you want, and the person sitting next to you doesn't hear it. And somebody in the front seat can take a phone call. And so, yeah, you don't imagine just a cocoon where you can't see anybody and they can't see you. You might be sitting next to someone in total privacy.
Mm-hmm. What is your sense of the possibility of buses? So I was just reading that Shenzhen in China, 100% electric buses.
Yeah.
Their entire fleet has gone electric.
Right.
The first city in the world. And there are 12 million people who live there, so it's not some minor little burg.
Yeah, no. China's going whole hog on electric buses. I want to say like something like 98% of the electric buses that are in the world today are either in China or made by Chinese companies.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got that segment locked up.
Yeah, they get 16,359 buses in that city are all electric. And London plans to go all electric by 2030 and New York City by 2040. So, I mean, here these guys are doing
They're
it right
there.
Now.
Yeah, remember, Shenzhen is like the Silicon Valley of China. It is the high-tech city of China. And it's like almost been built from scratch. So it was not a city that just sort of grew up over time. It was a planned, built city from the get-go in its current modern-day form. But, yeah, they're very proud that they see themselves as the most high-tech modern city in the world.
So if they're building this many buses for this one city, and there are obviously many big cities in China, I mean, I think they even consider, you know, cities with 6 million people as being small.
Oh, they are small by Chinese standards.
Yeah, by Chinese standards, but by
10 million is nothing.
Yeah, well, so is it possible that they're going to be developing the electrical capability for transportation in a way that, you know, Tesla certainly won't, or General Motors even certainly won't? That they'll have companies that are saying, "Hey, people are getting these in huge numbers, and therefore we're going to build the infrastructure and capacity to fulfill that."
Like I said, they've already locked it up. China has already locked up the electric bus segment in the world.
But what about the electric car segment?
They will become the leaders in that because it's government diktat that all you car companies are going to build electric cars, or else, i.e., you're going to have to buy credits, which are going to be hugely expensive, or you can make electric cars and sell those credits. As I'm sure you're aware, if you live in cities like Shanghai or Beijing, it costs something like $11,000 just to get a license plate.
And that's part of a lottery, too, so you don't have a guarantee of
exactly
when this is
going to
happen.
Whereas if you get an electric car, no, boom, here's the plate, no cost. On top of that, you can get something like another $7,000 or $8,000 in kickbacks from the government if you buy an electric car, depending on the range and all that. You know, the subsidies vary. But so, yeah, I mean, China's put its money where its mouth is. It wants to dominate the electric vehicle industry.
Okay, so we have electric vehicles, cars, crossovers, what have you, coming from companies like Audi and Mercedes and Porsche and so on, all aimed at giving Elon Musk a run for his money,
right?
Do you see, say, 5 years from now, that there'll be BYD or SAIC or some other Chinese company also entering into this market in the United States?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't think it'll take 5 years. I mean, it'll all depend on what happens between China and the U.S. from a trade standpoint. Are we going into a trade war? Are there going to be more tariffs? But if things stay as they are right now, you bet they're going to come here. The Chinese, like BYD, is going to have a massive cost advantage. The Chinese are already putting in place the supply chain necessary to dominate the global market in electric cars.
So what will be the consequence, do you think, to companies like Ford or FCA or General Motors?
Well, they'll still be players. I mean, they're going to be selling cars in China. They're going to be manufacturing electric cars in China. They're going to take full advantage of this. And they have better brand cachet. So that's how they'll be able to fight off the Japanese for right now.
Chinese.
Or the Chinese for right now. Thank you. But the real question is this really going to clean up China's air? It's going to move pollution out of the cities, to be sure. But still, even right now today, 70%-ish of China's electricity comes from coal. So all you're going to be doing is running these coal plants full blast. And yes, China has got, you know, hydropower, and they're getting into nuclear, and they're looking at renewables and blah, blah, blah. But all the charts show that the amount of coal they're burning now will not decline.
They just need clean coal. Come on, John. It's just got to be clean coal.
Well, brush it with toothpaste, I guess.
I mean, no one knows how that's done. But I just find it very interesting that, you know, I mean, the scale that we're talking about, I mean, it's enormous scale that they're going to have in terms of,
right,
you know, electrifying vehicles.
Right.
And I've got to believe that, you know, now there's certainly a price premium if you want to buy an electric car, right?
Yeah.
And if they're able to bring that power of scale, that the prices will go down so significantly that I've just got to believe that, you know, when you know, you've got, you know, let's say General Motors with the Bolt, right?
Yeah, one.
I mean,
that's one today.
Right, but I mean, what scale do you have?
No, they don't have a whole lot of scale in that regard, too. But, you know, one thing that you got to keep in mind is in China, they have these dinky little cheap cars that would never pass our crash standards.
Mm-hmm.
And it's electrified versions of them that dominate EV sales in China. So the kind of cars where they're starting to get their scale right now cannot be sold in a lot of the rest of the world.
Right.
They are certainly the developed world. They just don't meet the crash standards, mm-hmm, that we have. And so what you really got to wonder, though, is going forward, you know, with all this car sharing and ride sharing, do we even need as many cars?
Mm-hmm.
And the issues I've raised with electrics, too, is the batteries are massively energy intensive to manufacture,
mm-hmm,
and we don't know how to recycle these things,
right,
in volume for a profit. And so it's entirely possible, if those issues don't get resolved, a decade from now we'll go, you know, electric cars really aren't good for the environment.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of electric cars, AAA came out with a survey that indicates that 20% or 50 million Americans will, and I quote, likely go electric for their next vehicle purchase.
I don't believe those numbers for a second. What do you think of this?
I think it's preposterous because they're basically saying this is up from 15% in 2017. So that would have been 37 million people. So how many electric cars have been sold?
Yeah, not a lot.
It doesn't make any sense.
Well, you know, here's the thing that I'll say. We've seen similar surveys going back 10 years ago. 10 years ago, the same kind of survey asked at the time, will you buy a hybrid? And so many people said, oh, of course, I'm very interested in a hybrid, and I'm very likely to go buy one. That's what they told the pollsters. And then they go into the showroom and they go, ooh, I want the heated seats. I want the premium sound system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want the turbo. And all this talk that they told the pollsters of buying a hybrid goes out the window. And part of it's driven by the price. And so the example I like to use is, and I'm going by the Sunday papers where there's all these car ads. And I looked and I can get a Chevrolet Cruze for about $160 a month. If I want a Chevrolet Volt with a V, well, that's another $100 a month more. about $260 a month. And if I want a Chevy Bolt with a B, I'm looking at almost $400 a month. So people tell the pollsters, oh, yeah, I'm very interested. And then they look at the price and go, forget about it. I'm not paying that for the car. And so and I think there's another element going on here, too. I'd love to know, what kind of questions were they asked? How were these people sort of prepped for this survey? Do they ask them things like, do you think that we should have a clean environment? Oh, yeah, yeah, sure, I think we should have a clean environment. Do you think you should do your part? Oh, yeah, I'll do my part. Hey, are you going to look at buying an electric car? Oh, yeah, I'm very interested. So what I'm getting at, are these people telling the pollsters what they think they should be telling the pollsters? Because I don't believe for a second 50 million people are going to run out and buy an electric car.
See, and the thing that I wonder about is the term electric car appropriate to what they're actually talking about? Meaning, remember when there was the announcement that Volvo was going all electric by 2020, was it, or 2022?
Yeah, right.
Okay,
right.
And what does it mean? They're going to have electrified vehicles. So just as the e-torque system in the Ram 1500 would make it a hybrid vehicle, it's an electrified vehicle. It's not an electric vehicle.
Right.
And so maybe that gets wrapped into
it. Well, but I think the AAA survey was specifically talking about battery electrics.
Right, except for the fact that it goes on to say, while range is important to most, 87%, electric and hybrid vehicle shoppers. So I think that they sort of the hybrid thing comes in the back door. So, I don't think it's going to happen. But I think what we're going to end up having is a tremendous number of electrified vehicles that we won't even know they're electrified vehicles.
Yeah.
It'll be like
the e-truck.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
There are many now. Absolutely. And
what else is on your list?
So there was a, I know this will make you happy, that,
I'm already happy. I'm doing the show.
This will make you even more happy. So Uber had its second annual flying car summit in Los Angeles on Tuesday.
Uber Elevate?
And Uber and they brought in the acting administrator of the FAA to come talk to them about what they're going to do in terms of having a flying vehicle. Uber wants to have, they announced that they wanted to have commercial flying car services up and running by 2023. What do you think?
Bring it on. Let's make it happen. I'm all for it. I think I've been talking about autonomous cars for a long time, and people have been telling me it's never going to happen. Well, guess what? It's happening. And it was just a little over a year ago that I stumbled onto this thing of passenger drones. We got a picture up there on the screen right now. And I think this is going to catch on much faster than people think, because congestion, traffic jams are so bad in some areas. Here's a quick solution to that problem until the skies become jammed with passenger drones.
So apparently the FAA is a little bit hesitant about this, because they basically said, you know what, we've got such tremendous safety right now in terms of commercial aviation. 2017 was zero recorded fatalities in commercial jets on U.S. soil.
Great.
4 years in a row.
Because
planes
amazing.
Are taking off all the time.
Right.
And this administrator just basically said, we're not gonna degrade the safety that we have in the skies, and therefore we have to begin considering what you guys are going to be doing in terms of how we control those things in flight.
Yeah, no, it's going to require a totally separate air control system. We're not going to mix it with the commercial air control system we have today. And I think because of things like this Uber accident in Phoenix, where their autonomous car ran over a woman, and, Tesla having...
She'd be up in the sky if she was going to get run over.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at is now I think there's a recognition that, hey, we can't just let any company go out and start testing this autonomous stuff. You know, there's got to be some more than guidelines. We got to do some basic tests here. And I think it's prudent of the FAA to go, hold on a minute here, guys, with these passenger drones. But there's no question it's coming. I think it's going to come fast.
So what also happened is that Uber signed a second agreement with NASA And so one of the first places they want to have this air Uber service is Dallas-Fort Worth area. And so NASA wants to collect the information that they're going to be getting from that. And then they also signed an agreement, Uber and the U.S. Army. I thought people didn't like Uber, but apparently it's just signing all these deals left, right, and center. So the U.S. Army is spending Uber and the Army are going to spend $1 million on looking at developing a flying taxi. So we're getting a lot of interest by others besides you.
Yeah. Well, you know, because the economics all look so good. You know, at first, this is going to be business people who are in downtown areas that got to get to the airport or vice versa. And they don't want to spend an hour in traffic. They want to be there in 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. They'll pay for this. They'll just expense it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the economics very early on are going to look really good on this stuff. And congestion is a huge problem everywhere in the world. And remember, Geely, the Chinese company, has invested in passenger drones. Daimler has invested in passenger drones. Audi is working on passenger drones. So there's already automotive interest in all this. Uber is probably at the forefront of it. But look at who you've mentioned, because they are on board. DARPA is on board with this. The FAA is on board with this. NASA is on board with this. And there's a recognition in aerospace circles in the United States that the U.S. is the indisputed leader in aviation in the world, military and commercial. And this flying drone thing plays right into that. And there's a recognition that on those three parts, DARPA, NASA, and FAA, we better be at the forefront of this, too, or we're going to lose it.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of the woman who was hit by the Uber vehicle, that the IIHS did a study, and it turns out that the number of pedestrians getting killed by vehicles is going up.
By a lot.
Yeah.
Now, they're using 2009 as their baseline, and to me that's a little bit misleading, because 2009 was the middle of the Great Recession. Lots of people were out of work. Not as many people were driving. So they're saying, woo, from 2009 to now, there's been a massive increase.
Although they're saying that the number of vehicles that were killed in 2016, which was 5,987 people, that number is the highest since 1990.
Since 1990.
Right.
So we saw a big dip in 2009, and now we're coming back probably right on trend.
And so they're basically saying it's pedestrian crashes have become both deadlier and more frequent, and they're saying it's SUVs and high horsepower vehicles.
Yeah, well, that's the Insurance Institute for you. I would say it's idiot pedestrians with their face in their phone.
Could be.
I'd say that's far. They're saying, oh, look at the statistics. It shows more SUVs are killing people. Well, look at sales.
Yeah,
sales of SUVs have gone
SUVs
way up.
Out there to run
and they're saying,
over.
Oh, and high horsepower cars. Well, same story. So, look, I greatly admire so much of what the Insurance Institute has to say. They have a bone to pick with SUVs and high performance cars. They don't like those.
Hey, the Insurance Institute basically has a bone to pick like with every vehicle manufacturer, because if there is an accident of any sort, they end up paying out.
Yeah.
You know, so the money that we pay in, they get returned to us. So that's
Rewind please just wrote in to say it's smartphones. You know, since 2009 is when smartphones have really gone mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Rewind. I'm with that. I just think you see it all the time. People step right off the curb, not even looking to see if track, and they got their phone right in their face. There's all kinds of videos online of people falling downstairs, walking into fountains out mm-hmm. in parks and stuff like that. So I think phones are probably the bigger cause of this.
So we had on the show, gosh, it was sometime last year, the Project Portal, the Toyota hydrogen-powered Class 8
at the truck.
The Port of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Or Port of Long Beach. It doesn't matter.
One of those
ports. Port of one of those things. And so I was reading this week that in the ports of Los Angeles in Long Beach this week that six trucking firms are beginning to use renewable natural gas as a power source.
And define renewable natural gas. From sewage. I believe it's from sewage.
I don't know if this clean. There's a company called Clean Energy that is providing this stuff. I know that Toyota is beginning to use sewage for their stuff to build a closed loop. But and today, Total, the French petroleum,
which we used to pronounce Total,
right?
But now everyone calls it Total.
And I've never seen a Total station around here for how many years?
Oh, they disappeared from this area.
So they have just become the largest shareholder of this company, Clean Energy, which is providing the stuff. Anyway, the thing I wonder about is that, you know, we talk about hydrogen and we talk about electricity. What happened to natural gas-powered vehicles?
Here's the issue. The gas tank. The gas tank, I should call it the fuel system, costs a fortune. It's as expensive as batteries. So, you know, in a Bolt, the batteries are $12,000 plus. If you want to have a natural gas Honda Civic, the gas tank and the fuel lines add about $10,000 cost to the car. And literally, one of the tests is taking like a 30-odd-6 rifle and shooting it right into this tank, and the bullets have to bounce off. So, you know, because if there's any leak in an accident, the thing's going to go kablamo. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this Rock of Gibraltar kind of robustness in the fuel system in a natural gas car. Whoever figures out how to come up with a cheap gas tank that can take 12,000 PSI or whatever the number is that they're running it at, but I think that's around right, is going to be able to buy their own island. Whoever figures out how to get a low-cost gas tank for a natural gas car could clean up, because on a life cycle basis, CO2-wise, greenhouse gas-wise, it's right there with an electric car. Right. And natural gas right now is dirt cheap.
Right, and it's available, and you know most homes have natural gas that are...
Yeah, but you also have to put a pump at your house, because the natural gas going into your furnace is going in at a very low PSI. And like I said, if you want to really crank it up, for natural gas, or even better in my book, is propane, which can be stored at even lower pressure. But still, the tanks are the issue. Somebody's got to figure out how to do it really cheap if it's ever going to catch on, and that's why it has not.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that there could be a huge opportunity for that, because you can basically use a normal internal combustion engine with slight modifications.
Yeah, very slight.
And so you think of all the sunk costs that exist right now for manufacturing engines, and it's like, damn.
And to your point, this renewable natural gas, you can get it from sewage. You know, any landfill is giving off all kinds of methane and all kinds of stuff that can be captured. Mm-hmm. So, boy, talk about renewable. It would be fantastic to run our energy system off garbage.
Right. So now we're on this whole thing has been a subject of alternative fuels and fuel economy sort of related stuff. So, the automakers are supposed to go to Washington tomorrow to talk to the Trump administration about the possibility of doing something with CAFE. What's going on there?
Well, you know, what's going on is that publicly the car companies like Ford and GM and Toyota and others are saying, we don't want a rollback. Meanwhile, rollback of the fuel economy standards. Meanwhile, their lobbying group, the Automotive Alliance, is in Washington doing its damnedest to get those standards rolled back. So there's a little bit of a duplicity going on here of the automaker saying one thing publicly and letting their lobbying dogs go after the regulations. But what they're terrified about is that if the Trump administration rolls back too much, California is going to say, screw that. We're going ahead with our ZEV plan, and you know we're going to implement the next round of fuel economy improvements and emissions reductions. And 12 other states are going to go, California, we're with you. And now the auto industry has a massive headache of having to build vehicles for two different standards. And on the assembly line, that's not that big of an issue, because they make cars and trucks and whatnot that get exported to different countries with different emission standards and fuel economy standards and the like. The real headache is once those vehicles roll off the line, trying to track them to go to the proper state. They can't even keep track of the vehicles they make now to one standard. And so, boy, to have two different standards is going to be a nightmare, because if you're in a state that is following the California standard, and maybe it's even in California, but if you're right on the border with Nevada, and all of a sudden a vehicle across the state line is hundreds of dollars cheaper, you're going to run across the state line. Mm-hmm. And now how are you going to monitor that? And who monitors it? Is it the state? Does the dealer say, I can't sell you that? They don't want it. So one of the things that they're going to go to Trump tomorrow is say, we'd love some relief. Sotto voce, they'll say that. But don't piss off California, because we don't want two standards. Now, what Trump has said is, we're just going to cut California's head off, or its ability to set its own standard. We're not going to give them the waiver to do this. And then California is going to take it to court, and it's going to tie up in court for years. And that's, the last thing the industry wants.
Mm-hmm. So you think it'll go to court?
Well, look at Trump. You know, he says, I'm going to deal with Korea, and North Korea, he's doing it. I'm going to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. I've done it. I'm going to move our Israeli capital to Tel Aviv. He's done it. I'm going to back off. Jerusalem, excuse me. Thank you. Good to have you here, Gary, correcting all my mistakes. And now he's saying, I'm going to roll back fuel economy standards. You got to take him at his word. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to do it.
And is this long-term good for the American auto industry when, as you were saying earlier, that you expect there to be a whole bunch of Chinese electric vehicles rolling into this country within 5 years?
Well, no, I don't think it's good. But I would say this. The standards as they sit right now are too strict. 2022 to 2025 is like crazy rates of increase.
Sort of like the hockey stick.
Rates of increase we have never seen this industry achieve before, times two. And so that's why I've argued all along, keep the standards, don't make 2025 the goal, make 2030 the goal. So now you get another design generation out of it. Massive relief for the industry. You still get to the same numbers anyway. We'll see what Trump wants to do. Do they freeze it at 2020? Do they freeze it at 2022? Something like that. I don't know. But, for the automakers, they want to be in sync with what's going on in the entire world. Mm. That's how they can get planning and, you know, a reasonable amount of expenditures and get a return on their investment. When you start taking the U.S. off in a totally different direction than the rest of the world is going, they'll manage it, but it's just going to make it a whole lot more expensive for them.
And for the consumers.
And, those costs will get passed along. Mm-hmm. But I do agree with the industry, or maybe their lobbying group, that 2022 to 2025 is unrealistic with gasoline prices where they are in the U.S. right now.
Well, speaking of which, you mentioned pulling out of the deal with Iran, and immediately after that happened, the price of oil went up higher than it has been in some time. Now, on my way to work this morning, I saw gas at a Total station that was at $2.99 for regular, which in this area is high. This generally has moderate prices at this station since I drive by it every day.
Yeah.
$2.99. Now, while that isn't $4 a gallon, if we were to drive by that station last year, it would have been $2 a gallon. Therefore, the increase of a dollar is non-trivial.
Right.
So the question then becomes, what happens if we begin to see this price ratcheting up?
Well, you know, I'll just go by past behavior of consumers. If the price goes up relatively slowly, it's boil the frog slowly. Mm. Nobody notices. If there's a spike, everybody's going to run out of these Rams and go buy a Prius.
Right.
And that's what we've seen. If you go back to the 2008-2009 time frame, when we did see a big spike in prices, I could tell just by the way that people were driving. Everybody was doing the speed limit or even slower.
Right.
2 years later, it was still $4 a gallon, and everybody was back to 80 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's the rate of increase that affects buying habits more than the absolute price. Now, if it were to keep on going even slowly up to $7 a gallon, like it is in Europe, then, yeah, you would absolutely see changes. But as long as it goes up relatively slowly, we're not going to see big shifts in what people are buying. And I would say that oil is, and I'm going based on the experts I talked to. This is not my opinion. This is the opinion of experts that because of fracking, oil is probably going to settle into a range of $65 a barrel to $85 a barrel for as long as out as they can
look.
And
I think we're like at the middle point of
that
right now.
We're about 70 bucks right now, more or less. And so there's still more upside that it could go. But if you go back to 2008, 2009, it was $120 a barrel.
Right.
And everybody was sure it was going to 200.
Mm-hmm.
And now the oil experts I talk to, the energy experts I talk to, say now $65 to $85 a barrel, you know, out to 2040.
So if we have sustained gasoline at, let's say, $3.50 a gallon, okay, what happens to the demand for light-duty pickup trucks for people who are doing this purely out of recreational, not vocational interest, and large SUVs?
I don't think it's going to affect it that much because you're going to have e-torque. And the next generation is going to be even more lightweight than today. And there's going to be plug-in versions eventually. So, yeah, at $3.50 a gallon, $3.50, I don't see a whole lot of change. Again, assuming that it takes another year to get to $3.50 a gallon. If it goes to $3.50 a gallon next week, you'll see a change immediately.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, hey, we're going to have to wrap it up.
We should before we leave, we should give a shout out to a couple of our colleagues that we've had on the show, Lauren Fix and Chris Paukert.
And Kirk Bell.
And Kirk Bell for
new officers on North American Car and Truck of the Year mm-hmm. jury. And condolences to Gary because you ran too and didn't make the slates.
Because I have all those wacky numbers that I come up
with.
So it's probably just a good thing. And we'll actually, Chris will actually be here next week for the show.
Yeah.
So
talk about the show next week because I'm not going to be here.
Okay. So next week we're going to have a guy from a company, EOS, which makes rapid prototyping machines and 3D printing. So we've heard all about how this could conceivably revolutionize the auto industry. We're going to get a guy in here who's going to be able to give us the lowdown.
You'll separate the myth from the reality.
Exactly right. So
cool. Well, I'm going to watch that show, even though I'm not going to be on it.
Okay. Great.
Good. Okay. Good deal, Gary.
Thanks.
Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.